fellow Lonak with steady gaze. "They come at the Malesa's bidding, though not without misgivings. Then we'd best say hello." He told Derenna and the others to wait with Orvin's men, and rode forward with Kiral. They approached to within a few yards of the base of the hill, halting when one of the Lonak spurred his pony down the slope, a hulking man with a bearskin vest and a maze-like tattoo covering his shaven head. His face provoked a rush of recognition as he halted his pony a few yards away, regarding Valen with a baleful glare and greeting Kiral in terse Lonak. "This is Alturk," she told Valen, "Talesa of the Malesa Centaur." "We've met," Valen said, nodding at the big man. "Your son is well?" Alturk's face spasmed with anger, and Valen resisted the urge to reach for his sword as Kiral tensed beside him. "My son was Varnish," Alturk said in harsh realm tongue. "A worthless life well ended." Valen wondered if he should voice some word of sympathy, but guessed it would only be taken as further insult. "The Malesa has granted us passage," he said. "What is your purpose here?" Alturk gritted his teeth, speaking in slow, controlled tones, as if worried his anger might choke him. "The Malesa commands 100 of the Centaur follow you, the finest blood of the Lonakim to be spilled at your word. You know our course? We travel across the ice to the lands of our enemy. The dangers are many. Word from the mountain is not questioned." Alturk tugged on his reins, turning the pony. "Follow our track. Do not stray from it. There are few here who welcome your coming, and I give no promise of safety." They covered 30 miles by nightfall, the centaur setting a punishing pace through myriad canyons and valleys. Valen noted they rode with weapons ready, many holding bows with arrows notched, eyes constantly scanning the surrounding hilltops. His eyes also picked out a few riderless ponies among them, and noted some warriors sported recently bound wounds. "The Malesa asks much of our people in allowing your passage," Kiral explained, following his gaze. "The false Malesa may have fallen, but her words still linger in my ears."
"But you were the false Malesa," Valen said. "Won't your presence among us discourage them?"
Kiral smiled sadly. "When the Malesa freed me, I went forth from the mountain with my sisters, telling my story at the fires of every clan. It's a story welcome at any fire, being so rich in incident. Most believed it, some didn't, thinking me somehow turned from my true course by the Malesa. The thing that held me had a way with words, an ability to plant the seeds of doubt in the hearts of those already versed in malice and cruelty. It's easier to hate when given a reason, and she had many." They encamped amidst the crags of a low plateau some hours later, Alturk posting a heavy guard on all approaches. Most of the centaur seemed content to stay away from the Merim Her, but not all were so wary. One stocky woman approaching to peer at Darenna as she unsaddled her horse, speaking in rapid Lonak. "I don't know your language," Darenna said, clearly discomforted by the scrutiny. "She asks if you belong to the Arrowglass clan," Kiral explained. "Your face reminds her of a cousin she lost years ago." Darenna offered the stern-faced Lonak woman a cautious frown. "Lost how?"
"A raid," Kiral related.
"An entire village was wiped out. Her cousin died along with her sisters and their children. They thought it the Siorda, but the tracks were wrong, and the Siorda never killed children." Darenna's expression became more intent, and she laid down her saddle, stepping closer to the Lonak woman.
"Did her cousin have a name?"
"Mileka," Kiral translated. "It means owl." She paused as the Lonak woman spoke on. "She asks if you have a story for the fire."
"Yes."
Darenna gave a reluctant nod. "I have a story." The Lonak woman brought a dozen or so more centaur to hear the story, squatting around the fire as Kiral translated Darenna's tale. The presence of Wise Bear and Iron Claw was an obvious source of discomfort, but apparently not sufficient to assuage the desire for a new tale. They sat, clearly fascinated, as she related her dim memory of the destruction of her village. Some became agitated when she mentioned the wolf that had borne her through the forest, but they all stayed until she finished, relating how Lord Almurna had found her and made her his daughter.
nodding and grunting in appreciation as she fell silent.
They liked it, Kirill said, a note of relief in her voice. A good story means much to my people.
She tensed somewhat as Alturk stepped from the shadow of a nearby crag, arms crossed and gaze fixed on Dorena.
You lived as Merimher, he said, but your arms are adorned with Siorda trinkets.
I am both Merimher and Siorda, she replied evenly, in soul if not in blood.
Alturk grunted something that might have been a laugh.
Lonak blood doesn't weaken so easily. You may feel it swell again before this tale is done.
He growled something at the onlooking centaur, and they quickly scrambled to their feet before disappearing into the shadows.
Be sure to wake before dawn, he told Valin, stalking back into the night.
The first attack came the following day, as they traversed a deep canyon half a day's march from the plateau. A group of some 2 dozen Lonak appeared out of a cave mouth to launch a volley of arrows before hurling themselves at the centaur, clearly intent on fighting their way through to the hated Merimher. Only one managed to breach the cordon, the others being clubbed down or speared in short order, seemingly without any loss to the centaur. The lone warrior ran directly for Valin, screaming madly with a war club raised, then skidding to a halt as Ironclaw lumbered into his path. The Lonak stared, eyes wide in horror as the bear bellowed his challenge, rising to his full height. The warrior dropped his club, apparently now unreasoned by terror and numb to the arrow that punched through his chest a second later. Kirill walked to the corpse, bow in hand, kicking his legs to make sure before kneeling to reclaim her arrow. They were attacked again 3 nights later, though this time their assailants were content to linger in the shadows and loose arrows at the campfires, claiming the life of a centaur who had stepped in front of the glow at the wrong moment. Alturk gathered together 20 warriors and led them into the darkness, returning a little while later with bloodied clubs and lance points. Their efforts seemed to have been enough to ensure an untroubled night, and a group of centaurs soon appeared at their fire in search of a story in what was becoming a nightly ritual.
"I'll take a turn," Orvin said.
"The tale of Lord Valin's charge at the Battle of Altor."
Valin got to his feet with a groan.
"Spare me."
"But they want a story, my lord," Orvin said with a small grin. "I, however, do not."
He walked away from the fire as Orvin began the tale, moving through the camp where the other centaur greeted him with cautious eyes or studied indifference. He found Alturk sitting alone, wiping a buckskin rag over his war club, a recently sharpened knife placed close to his side.
"I come to ask more of your son," Valin said. "I hope my actions had no part in his death."
Alturk didn't look up, grunting,
"Your hope is wasted.
You killed him for disobeying the Malesa?"
The Lonak's eyes rose from his work, bright with warning.
"My clan killed him. His death was right and just, and I'll speak no more of it."
Valin moved to the fire, squatting down to extend his hands to the warmth. The nights grew ever colder, the northerly winds stiff with ample warning of what lay ahead.
"My queen told me men are forbidden the company of your Malesa," he said.
"You have never met her, yet you follow her word without question."
"Do you question your queen?"
Valin grinned a little.
"Not openly."
Alturk failed to respond, putting his war club aside and settling his gaze on the fire. Valin saw that the years had aged his face, if not his body, lines etched deep into the ink around his eyes.
"You should know," he told the Lonak. "I believe few of us will return from this journey. Those not claimed by the ice may well fall in battle."
Alturk sat in silence for several minutes, watching the fire with his aged eyes. Finally, as Valin made to leave, he said, "A man already dead need fear nothing." 2 more weeks brought them in sight of the ice, a ribbon of white on the eastern horizon, beyond a curving shoreline fringing grey ocean waters. The mountains had begun to diminish in size in recent days, until now they were but foothills, mostly bare of greenery and affording little cover to their enemies. The attacks had become more sporadic the farther north they travelled, possibly through simple weariness, though Valin suspected the constant attrition exacted by the centaur to be the main reason. For all their lack of uniformity or soldierly custom, they were every bit as disciplined as any company from the Sixth Order, and perhaps nearly as skilled. Only two more had been lost since the night raid.
"Faith that bites," Lorcan said, wincing at the cutting wind and casting a questioning glance at Kara. "Can't you do something?"
She confined her response to a disgusted glance and dismounted as Wise Bear arrived with Ironclaw. The horses had grown only partially accustomed to the bear's presence, and the shaman usually travelled at a short remove from the main body of the company, bouncing along on the beast's back. There was an odd wariness in the Lonak's attitude to Wise Bear, moving around him with a cautious silence, and he was the only one of the outsiders not required to share a story at the fire.
"Hello, you," Kara said, scratching at Ironclaw's mighty head, the animal snorting in pleasure and hunkering down at her feet, though his shoulders still reached as high as her chest.
"Need hunt more," Wise Bear told Valin. "More meat."
"We have meat," Alturk said. "Enough for a month's travel, at least."
"Not on ice," the shaman insisted. "Need more and more."
"From where?"
Alturk gestured at the barren country around them.
"There's nothing to hunt here."
Wise Bear stared at him for a moment, then gave one of his cackling laughs, pointing towards the shoreline.
"Sea brings gifts, painted man."
Wise Bear disappeared with Ironclaw for several hours before returning to lead them to a cliff overlooking the bay where the beasts made their home. There were perhaps 40 of them, crowding the rocky shore, plump, fur-covered bodies flopping around as they squabbled and barked at each other, impressive tusks bared.
"What are they?"
Lorcan asked, his voice kept to a whisper, although they were a considerable distance from the creatures.
"Fur seals," Derena replied. "We have them on the northern shores of the reaches, though I don't recall seeing any so big."
"Big," Wise Bear agreed with a happy nod. "Big meat to take on ice."
"It'll spoil," Alturk stated, "and we have not the salt to preserve so much."
Wise Bear replied with a baffled frown, and it took some time for Valin to translate the meaning.
"Spoil, ha! Meat not spoil on ice. Too cold. Just smoke over fire. Keep many, many days."
He beckoned to Kiral and started for a narrow track leading to the shore.
"We hunt, you build fires."
They toiled on the shoreline for the best part of another week, building fires and butchering the unfortunate seals at Wise Bear's instruction. He skinned the first victim with an unconscious and rapid skill, harvesting a complete hide with seemingly only a few strokes of his knife, a feat none of them managed to match despite continued labour. The meat was cut into strips and hung over the fires to smoke whilst the hides were set aside to be cured, the shaman making it clear they would be needed later, his eyes constantly returning to the white line on the horizon.
"Have we made the journey too late?"
Valin asked him on the last night.
They sat together on a rocky outcrop near the shingle beach where the bloody work had been done, Ironclaw happily munching on a pile of entrails nearby.
"Still time,"
Wise Bear raised a hand, the thumb and forefinger forming a narrow gap.
"Small time."
He glanced over his shoulder at the camp, where a crowd of centaur were listening as Kirol translated Lorcan's somewhat ribald version of The Woodsman's Daughter, a cautionary tale of unrequited love involving murder and adultery, though not usually in such quantity or detail.
"Not all make the islands," Wise Bear went on. "Way of things on the ice. Always take some. Even bear people."
"The islands?" Valin asked.
"Where we go. Other side of ice. Home of bear people once."
"I thought your people lived on the ice."
Wise Bear shook his head, eyes moving to the ice once more. It seemed to glow, lit by a pale green luminescence in the night sky, the Lonak called Grishak's breath, in honor of their wind god.
"Only small times," Wise Bear said. "Our travel to your land, the most time ever on ice for bear people."
Valin recalled the emaciated, hollow-eyed folk clustered at Stillwater Creek, a nation raised to survive the harshest climbs, and yet still brought to their knees by the ice.
"I would not ask this of any soul," he said. "If I didn't know in my heart, it must be done."
Chapter 6 Lerna.
"Are there no words I can speak to dissuade you from this course?" They had requested the audience early that morning, and stood before her now in the throne room, Hera Dracul's hawk face betraying no emotion, while Stannis Poltar at least managed a regretful grimace. "War is won," he said with a shrug. "The elk herds grow with no one to hunt them. Eat all the grass. We are needed on the plains." Lerna turned to the Siorda war chief, speaking in her barely adequate Siorda. "And you, forest brother?" "We heeded the wolf's call," he replied. "Now it fades. The forest calls us home." "The finest light infantry and cavalry in the world," Venin had called them. "Not assets to be easily lost." "Our enemies will return if we cannot defeat them," she told them. "And when they do, I may not be able to shield you from their savagery." "We fought for this land," Hera Dracul insisted. "We are glad to have done so. The land across the Great Water is not ours to fight for." She knew there was something more behind his words, a faint flicker in his eyes she knew all too well. She recalled the forest people's discomfort in Lady Dorena's presence, their inherent revulsion at what she had done for Valin, and their intense dislike of the sea. The Siorda saw much when they left the forest, she surmised, and came to no fear. "You swore no oath to me," she said, "so I cannot compel your loyalty. And I would be a fool and a liar to claim this realm would now be free without your help. Please journey home safely with my thanks, and rest assured, the Siorda and Erhil will enjoy the friendship and protection of the unified realm for all the ages." They surprised her by bowing, something she had seen neither do before. "If the Dark Hearts come back," Hera Dracul said as he straightened, "we will fight with you again." They left at noon, Lerna watching from the walls as the great mass of Erhil galloped away north, the Siorda following in their loose tribal formations, some adorned with various trinkets gathered during their sojourn. "A grievous loss, Highness," Count Marvin commented at her side. "They would have done fine work across the ocean." "The Realm Guard is already 3 times their number," Lerna said, striving to ensure her confidence didn't sound forced. "And not all have left." She nodded at the Siorda and Erhil, encamped near the gatehouse, perhaps 300 warriors who had opted to stay. Some had formed close bonds with the realm folk they had met on the march, even a few marriages. She could see Lord Orvin's rapidly blossoming wife moving among the elk-hide shelters. Others had elected to join her crusade in pursuit of justice for the many outrages witnessed during the campaign. The remainder, possessed of nothing more than basic curiosity, a desire to see what lay beyond the Great Water. The Erhil elder, Wisdom, was chief among the latter. "I find there is always room in my head for more knowledge, Highness," she had said in answer to Lerna's query. "At least we won't have to find room for so many horses," her new battle lord continued, "burdened as we are with the Renfalen knights and our own cavalry." He paused, no doubt mustering the nerve to voice unwelcome advice. "Highness, the fleet grows daily, but also slowly. Consequently, I believe it may be necessary to send the army in 2 waves, the first carrying the elite of the Realm Guard and Lady Reva's archers. They will secure a defensible port, whilst the fleet returns for the remainder." Lerna watched the last of the Siorda disappear over a distant rise. She fancied there was a single figure who lingered a moment. Hera Dracul, perhaps, or just a warrior looking on a place he never hoped to see again. "Is there a countess, Marvin?" she asked. "A family waiting for you in Nilsail?" "In Frostport, yes. My wife and 2 sons. You should bring them here. They will be very welcome at court." "I doubt that, Highness. My wife is possessed of a difficult temper. Within a day of her arrival, she would be demanding her own palace." "Ah." She turned from the view as the lone Siorda disappeared from sight. "Attacking in small numbers will avail us nothing, my lord. The Valerians have lost many soldiers, but their empire is rich in more. We will descend upon them in but 1 wave, washing their filth from the land in the process. Forgive me, Highness, but we do not possess even half the number of ships required." "No," she agreed. "A state of affairs I expect to see rectified shortly." Dvorka waited with the horses in the palace courtyard. "It's done," Lerna asked her in Lonak, climbing onto Arrow's back.
It was as you foretold, Devoka replied, her bland expression at odds with her tone.
Pity.
Lerna turned Arrow towards the palace gate. Let us find a welcome distraction.
Varen's soul thrummed with activity as they rode through the streets, flanked by Benton and Iltis. People pausing to bow or call out a loyal greeting before hurrying to their tasks. For all its bustle, the fabric of the city was scarcely healed, a few newly completed buildings rising from the devastation, and these only plain, functional barracks devoid of aesthetic value. Malcius would have wept, she knew, surveying her capital, now a city of canvas and wood rather than stone. He did so love to build. The activity was even more intense at the docks. Varenshold was a port city, but had traditionally built few ships, most of the realm's vessels being the product of the South Tower and Warnsclave yards, where thousands now laboured at a frantic pitch to give her the fleet she demanded, though never fast enough. Winter was upon them, and no more than a dozen new ships were ready, and these only warships of traditional design. An exasperated Lord Davin had advised that building a vessel on the dimensions she required would demand the construction of a completely new yard. "Then build it, my lord," she told him simply. The Queen's Forge, as it had come to be called, occupied much of the wharf previously taken up by the city's warehouses, a sprawling collection of smithies and workshops where skilled artisans laboured day and night in 10-hour shifts. They were former apprentices mostly, young enough to run from the slavers who had claimed their masters, many having to be extracted from the ranks of the realm guard, often at great protest. As per her strict orders, they gave no pause to bow as she entered the forge, though there were many quick glances of awe or admiration to greet her. She proceeded through the cacophony of pounding metal and ceaseless saws to the cavernous space, where Alornis waited with Lord Davin, and rising behind them, the hull of a vessel fully 30 feet high. Lerna's gaze tracked over the scaffolding that covered her sides, and the rites working caulking and pitch into the upper seams.
"I was given to believe she stood ready to launch, my lord," she said to Davin.
"Finishing touches only, Highness," he assured her with a weary bow, turning and extending a hand to the newborn ship.
"I give you the realm's pride. 160 feet long, 45 at the beam, a draft of 23, and capable of carrying 500 fully armed realm guard, the breadth of any ocean. And," Alornis added in a prim voice, "constructed in only 20 days by less than 100 men.
"So," Lerna said to Davin, "it worked."
"Indeed, Highness," he inclined his head at Alornis, "my initial scepticism seems to have been unfounded."
Lerna moved closer to the ship, pausing to take Alornis's hand, squeezing it tight.
"Thank you, my lady. I hereby name you the Queen's Artificer. Now the ship is done, I would ask you turn your mind to the prosecution of the war. We will face great numbers in Valeria. I should be grateful for any devices you can conceive that might even the odds somewhat." She felt Alornis's hand twitch in her grip.
"I know little of weapons, Highness."
"You knew little of ships, yet that seemed to be of scant matter. I await your designs with interest." She released her hand and turned to Davin.
"When does she launch?"
"The evening tide, Highness. The masts should be fitted within 2 days.
Have copies of the plans sent to the yards in Warnsclave and South Tower. No other design is to be followed from this day on."
"Yes, Highness."
Her eyes picked out the lettering on the hull. "The realm's pride. Fitting, but hardly inspiring."
"And change the name," she added, turning to go. "She's to be called the King Malcius. I shall provide a list of titles for her sisters."
The dead company was obliged to encamp beyond the city walls. Count Marvin had given them a watchtower on the northern headland to guard, a decent remove from many veteran realm guard and former slaves keen to settle old scores. She found Alhestian training his men with customary gentility.
"Get up, you worthless shit-eater!"
he growled at a prostrate youth, clutching his belly where the Lord Marshal had delivered a blow with the butt of his halberd.
"Guts enough to steal, but not enough to fight, eh? Let yourself be beaten down by a crippled old man."
He delivered a vicious kick at the boy's legs as he continued to cower. Up, or it's a flogging!
Alhestian straightened as Lerna guided arrow closer, ignoring his bow and looking down at the cringing youth. He stared up at her with bright appeal, tears swelling in his eyes.
Little more than a boy, she realized. Your Lord Marshal gave you an order, she told him quietly, returning his stare and knowing he saw no kindness in her gaze.
The boy got to his feet, fighting tears and sketching a bow.
Sergeant!
Alhestian barked, and a broad-shouldered man came running to his side, saluting smartly. Lerna recognized him as the knight from the dungeons, the one who had cried when she gave them their lives.
Run this coward until he drops, Alhestian told him. No run for a week.
This one would do well among the Lonakim, Devoka commented at Lerna's side.
Alhestian came forward to hold Lerna's reins as she dismounted. She could see a new vitality in him, the defeated man from the traitor's nook seemingly replaced by the epitome of a realm guard Lord Marshal, which, she reminded herself, he had once been. However, his straightened back and perfect uniform couldn't mask his eyes. They still told of a man in the midst of grief.
"My lord," she said, gesturing at the bluffs where Orenna and Mural were laying out a table and chairs.
"I come to watch my new ship's first voyage. Would you care to join me?"
He had his men light lanterns and hang them from poles along the clifftop, sitting stiffly opposite her as the sun faded and a harsh seaward breeze drew a whisper from the grass.
"How do you find your new command, my lord?" Lerna asked him,
accepting a cup of wine from Orenna.
"A mixed bag, Highness. Knights seeking to reclaim their honour serving alongside the scum of the realm. My Black Hawks could have slaughtered them all in a day."
"Yes, had they not been wiped out, of course."
She looked at the wine in her cup, a dark Cumbrelian red, the scent sweet, holding a tinge of mint and blackberry.
"Any desertions?"
"Two, Highness. They were recent recruits, witless outlaws in truth, with little notion of how to evade capture. They were easily returned."
"And flogged, I presume?"
"Hanged, Highness, in front of the whole regiment." He nodded his thanks at Orenna as she poured his wine. "Examples must be set."
"Quite so. I would prefer not to drink with you," she added as he made to sip the wine.
He hesitated a moment, then laid down his cup, his face betraying no sign of offence.
Benton turned back from the clifftop, pointing toward the harbour.
"My queen!"
Lerna rose, beckoning Alhestian to join her. The headland offered an excellent view of the docks, where many torches glimmered as people crowded the wharf to watch the birth of the queen's mighty ship. The forge had been built with the slipway jutting out into the harbour, the interior glowing bright and bathing the waters in a yellow glow. Even from this distance, she could hear the sound of multiple mallets pounding the blocks that held the vessel in place, fading abruptly to be replaced by a huge cheer from the wharf as the great hull slid down the slipway and into the water, her wake shimmering like gold in the torchlight.
"She makes a fine sight, don't you think?"
Lerna asked Alhestian, gesturing for Orenna to bring more wine.
He watched the ship for a moment, his sunken eyes brightening only a fraction.
"An impressive vessel, Highness."
"Yes. I must confess I have misled you somewhat, Lord Marshal. My mission here tonight was not to show you my ship."
She saw him tense, glancing at Iltis and Benton, who stood a little way off on either side, eyes hard and hands resting on their sword hilts.
"It was not, Highness?"
"No."
Lerna turned as Orenna approached, meeting her gaze and tipping her wine onto the grass.
"It was to show you the face of our enemy."
Orenna froze, all expression draining from her features, but her eyes flicked across them all with an unnatural speed.
"Lord Valin noticed," Lerna told her. "You saw the boy who can't be seen, unless by another gifted. That was foolish."
Orenna didn't move, her eyes settling on Lerna as Benton and Iltis closed in on either side, swords drawn and levelled, Devoka moving behind her with spear poised.
"Orenna Vardrian," Lerna continued. "Family names follow the female line among the farming folk of Azrael. Brother Harlech has memorized every census ever taken in this realm, so it was an easy task to discern that you and Lord Valin are cousins. sharing a grandmother, one who no doubt passed her gifted blood to both daughters. Maternal blood carries the dark, but the nature of the gifts can vary between generations. What is hers?
Orena's features spasmed, a variety of expression marring her mask-like visage, malice, fear, and amusement all flickering across her face before settling on the most unexpected, sadness, her brow softening and mouth forming a slight grimace. When she spoke, her voice was flat, though Lerna found the cadence horribly familiar. She can place her thoughts in the heads of others, a difficult gift to master, and one she rarely used, being so terrified of discovery, knowing her own people would deliver her to the Fourth Order should it become known. Little wonder she determined to escape the farm and marry a rich husband. She made great use of her gift during the courtship. "And to tell your fellow creature and his pet priest where to find me that night at Altor." Iltis bared his teeth, sword quivering a little as he fought his rage, though she was gratified by the discipline he displayed in not surrendering to it. "A task I was forced to," Orena said, "like countless others. More than once, no doubt. I assume our enemies are fully aware of our preparations." "They know all I know." "So why risk discovery tonight? Lady Devoka has kept careful watch on you since Lord Valen imparted his suspicions. Why choose tonight to poison my wine?" Orena said nothing, though Lerna saw her eyes flick in Alhestian's direction. "It seems our enemy fears you also, my lord," Lerna told the Lord Marshal. "I find myself suddenly glad I didn't execute you." She leveled her gaze at Orena once more. "Why does the ally want his death?" "He has a genius for command, one that will be of great use when you reach Valeria. We have met before, have we not? In the mountains." "It matters not." The woman's voice grew yet more devoid of emotion, her gaze losing focus, shoulders slumping in defeat. "Nothing matters. Build your fleet, gather your army, sail them to their deaths. We're all but pieces on his board, and if the game goes awry, he'll start another. I have died 100 times and woken in shell after shell, each time praying that this time he will leave me be. When I first awoke in this one, I heard no whisper of his voice, and I thought..." She fell silent, head lowering as she hugged herself. "You had ample opportunity to kill me on the Sea Saber," Lerna said. "During the battle, it would have been an easy matter with so many arrows flying, so much smoke to conceal the deed. Why didn't you?" Orena issued a wistful laugh, soft and soon lost to the wind. "You made me a lady. You were my queen. And..." She paused to smile. "And there was Harvin. To live so long without ever touching another heart is a terrible thing. To think I should find it with him, a common outlaw with no more wit than a scavenging fox. You expect me to believe this?" Lerna felt her anger quicken, and fought to keep it in check. This thing's attempt to manipulate her was dangerous, provoking her to hasty revenge. A creature such as you is immune to love. "You think yourself so wise, my queen, but you are still a child. I have seen much done in the name of love, the wondrous and the horrifying, always finding it so amusing. There is a corner of my soul that wishes you were right, that I had remained immune to its touch, for then my grief would not have been so great. I think that's how he found me again, hearing my despair as it seeped into the void, calling me back to his service. A call you could have refused. He bound me to him long ago, welded my soul to his, cutting away any will to resist. It's how he chooses us, those souls best suited to his purpose, those with malice sufficient to match his own and weakness enough to be moulded." She sank to her knees, glancing over her shoulder, where Devoka now stood, a small glass bottle in hand. "You should know," Orena said, turning back to Lerna, "that the mind of this shell is fractured, broken by rape and near strangulation the night the city fell, saved only by her gift,
which shattered the mind of her assailant, but left her spent and easily claimed.
"She will have the best care," Lerna said.
"And I promised Lord Valin I would return his cousin."
Orena nodded and drew back her sleeve, raising her hand, palm extended.
"This time there will be no forgiveness. My failures become too frequent, my soul too sullied by feeling. This time he will rend me to nothing, stripping away even the memory I was once alive. A fate, I believe, will suit me very well."
Her face was set, determined, her fear well controlled, a stark contrast to the girl who had begged and wailed beneath the mountain.
"I am ready, my queen." In later years, there would be few among the dead company left alive to recall the scream that pealed across the headland that night. But those that did, although calloused by many horrors, would still manage a shudder at the memory of the sound, recalling it as an omen of what lay ahead. The full fury of winter came early that year, heavy rain giving way to snow with unwelcome speed, the tent roofs of Varenshold sagging under its weight. Lerna had ordered fuel stockpiled, but the depth of the cold took many by surprise, and there were some who perished in its grasp, mainly the old and the sick. Others were found outside the city walls, shorn of warm clothing, their frozen faces often serene, accepting. The invasion had left many bereft of all family, and vulnerable to despair, precious hands lost to grief that wouldn't heal. Despite the cold and the privation, the work continued. The forge produced weapons at a furious rate, and Davern's rights had given her 3 more ships in less than a month, the pace of construction quickening as they grew accustomed to the new techniques.
"You should forget the gold from the Reaches, Highness," Davern advised one day, with his customary grin. "When the war's won, this land will be made rich on shipbuilding alone." In truth, she often wished she could forget the gold. Acting Tower Lord Ultin was a frequent correspondent with his demands for more miners, and Fief Lord Darvis's scribes were scrupulous in counting and weighing every ingot to reach Frostport, even to the point of delaying onward shipment to the Alpiran merchants.
"If your highness were to send more scribes," the old man had written in response to her gently worded rebuke, "I feel sure the flow of gold would resume with all alacrity."
She had resisted the urge to dispatch Lord Adal with a formal edict, dissolving Darvis's agreement with Valin and placing the gold trade under crown control. However, as her Minister of Justice was ever keen to remind her, she had already exercised the Queen's word with a frequency that made her father appear the paragon of light-handed rule, and was loath to earn a reputation for setting aside inconvenient laws. Aspec Dendrish had taken on the unenviable task of hearing petitions, troubling her with only the cases of greatest import or complexity. He also had been obliged to reconstitute a system of courts in a land now severely denuded of lawyers or magistrates, obtaining her permission for a complete reorganization of the realm's machinery of justice.
3 senior judges?" she asked him on reading his plan. "Should the role of highest judge not fall to you, Aspect?
Too much power vested in a single office is often a recipe for corruption, Highness." She gave him an amused frown. Although possibly the least personable man she had met, besides the blessedly deceased Darnell, the Aspect had quickly earned a reputation for sound judgment and rigid impartiality, reporting every attempted bribe and decreeing swift punishment on the transgressor.
"You feel corrupted by your duties?" she asked.
"I will not hold this office forever." There was a weight to his words that gave her pause, taking in the paleness of his skin and rapidly disappearing girth. She had noticed before how his words were often coloured by a faint wheeze, and he would pause to cough with a disconcerting frequency.
3 judges," she said, turning back to the document. "To ensure their decisions are not deadlocked, I assume?"
"Indeed, Highness. All rulings to be subject to your approval, naturally. Also, I note there is no mention of the faith in your amended code of criminal transgressions.
The faith pertains to the soul and the beyond. The law pertains only to the realm and its subjects."
"Very well. I shall need time to fully consider this."
"My thanks, Highness."
He hunched over, trying to suppress a cough and failing, a lace handkerchief held to his mouth, coming away spotted with red.
Forgive me.
I will. I'll also order you to see Brother Kellen immediately, and abide by whatever instruction he gives you. He gave a reluctant nod as she set down the document, musing, Neither my brother nor father ever attempted such radical change to the realm's laws. Aspect Dendrish drew a wheezing breath, his eyes slightly moist as he replied, All in this realm is changed, more than I would ever wish it to be. But wishes do not make a land fit to live in. It's based on a Valerian engine, Alorna said, her slender arm working the windlass at the rear of the contraption, gears clanking and diagonally crossed arms drawing back. It did indeed resemble one of the ballista with which the Valerians festooned their ships, but was substantially larger, with a heavy iron box fixed over the central body. It stood on a wide base, also of iron, but with a bowl-shaped aperture through which a supporting rod was thrust, allowing the entire engine to be swiveled about with surprising swiftness despite its size. Lerna had joined her battle lord on the Realm Guard's main practice ground to witness the trial of her lady artificer's first invention. The broad plain that played host to the Summertide Fair was mostly covered in snow now. Troops of conscripts laboring through the drifts, a good way beyond the row of targets, placed at varying distances from the device. Each target consisted of four Valerian breastplates arranged in a square, Alornis having assured them the device had enough power to pierce their armour.
"The range, my lady?" Count Marvin inquired.
"A Valerian ballista can manage about 200 yards, Alornis replied, locking the engine's thick string in place and stepping back. "I'm hopeful we'll better it. They use wood for their bow staves. We have used steel." She took a moment to align the contraption, then thumped her palm onto a lever. The bow arm snapped forward in a blur, the bolt flying free too fast for Lerna to track its flight, though the tinny clunk from one of the farthest targets indicated it had found its mark.
"Close to 300 yards, Count Marvin said with a laugh, bowing to Alornis. "Well done, my lady. A remarkable feat."
"Thank you, my lord, but I am not yet done. The original Valerian design was slow to load, taking over a minute to loose two bolts. However, I recalled seeing a grain seeder, which gave me an odd notion." She reached for the windlass again and began to work it, the arms drawing back as the gears rattled anew. "It's all a matter of aligning the cogs," she explained, grunting a little with the effort. "The gears draw the string back to a certain point, whereupon the box on the top releases a new bolt." A faint clatter came from the engine as she continued to work the windlass. "And the next gear releases the string." The bow arm snapped again, scoring another hit on the farthest target. "All one need do is continue to turn the windlass," Alornis went on, adjusting the engine's aim so that the next bolt flew towards a different target. "Until the bolts are exhausted, whereupon a new box can be hauled up to replace it." She continued to work the engine, loosing bolts at various trajectories until all targets had sustained a hit. When the last bolt had flown, she stood back, perspiring a little despite the cold. "Still some details to work out," she said, chest heaving a little. "It tends to seize up if it's not oiled frequently, and I think I can improve on the design of the bolt heads."
"Give me 100 of those, Highness," Count Marvin said, his tone now entirely serious, "and I'll match us against any army the Valerians can field."
Lerna went forward to favour Alornis with a soft embrace, planting a kiss on her forehead. "What else can you show me, my lady?"
Chapter 7 Frentis. Ilion ducked under the arc of his wooden blade and countered with a jab at his eyes, easily turned before stepping close to trap her arm under his shoulder, pulling her close.
"Now what will you do, sister?" he asked in a light tone. He saw her bite back a retort, features red with frustration, detecting the decision in her eyes a fraction of a second too late. Her forehead connected painfully with his nose, leaving him stunned for the brief moment it took her to wrestle free, her ash sword coming round in a clumsy but fast swipe at his midriff. His wooden blade connected with hers an inch from his chest, deflecting it with a loud crack, then sweeping it aside to thrust into her belly. She grunted from the blow and lowered her sword, chest heaving and eyes dark with resentment. "Anger is your enemy," he reminded her, wiping blood from his nose. "A little better this time, but still not fast enough. Practice your scales until midday, then feed the dogs." She took a deep, calming breath before nodding, her tone carefully modulated. "Yes, brother." He left her to it and strode across the deck, where his company were engaged in their own practice. Draker teaching a trio of their younger members the basics of cutting a man's throat. "Gotta get it done in one stroke," he advised, a beefy arm around the chest of a lanky youth named Dallin, a Renfalian farmhand rescued from slavers shortly before their time in the Erlish reached its disastrous conclusion. "Forget about finding the veins." Draker demonstrated the technique with a sheathed dagger. "Just cut deep and draw it all the way around. Then get hold of his hair and pull the head back to open the cut as wide as you can." Frentis passed Weaver on the way to the stern, Slasher and Blacktooth at his side, as they often were these days, seemingly fascinated by his work. Halfway through the voyage, he had abruptly stopped plaiting rope and begun working strips of leather into a tight arrangement fixed onto a circular frame, replying with only a vague smile when asked what he was about. The creation had initially resembled a shallow basket, but its purpose had gradually become clear as Weaver fixed straps to the concave side and borrowed pitch from the crew to cover the curving outer surface. "A fine shield, sir," Frentis offered, pausing at his side and raising a hand for Slasher to lick. "A Lonak design," Weaver replied, an oddly familiar cadence to his voice as he used a large bone needle to thread twine along the edge of the shield. "Though rarely used, since their martial culture is essentially aggressive in nature." He continued to work, not looking up as Frentis moved on. Captain Bellarath was at the stern, standing as still as the shifting deck would allow, his sextant trained on the horizon. Frentis had no notion of how the device worked, or the meaning of the numbers the captain paused to scribble on parchment, but knew it was how he fixed their position on this ocean. "Sea's a calmer today," he offered. In fact, it was the first calm day for over a week. The stories he had heard of the Borelian's tempestuous, wintry nature had not been exaggerated. Bellarath replied with a customary grunt, raising his sextant once more. "But the clouds aren't. Promises another storm by tomorrow." He squinted, keeping the sextant level, his eyes tracking to a brief glimpse of the sun through the cloud. "I believe, brother," he said, consulting the numbers on his parchment, "we are less than 2 weeks from Valerian shores. It's time a decision was made." Escethia. 34's finger tapped the chart, where a 200-mile-long stretch of Valerian coastline traced from north to south. "One of the last provinces to fall to Valerian rule. The free people there may be less inclined to fight for the Empire. Also, New Kethia is a home to the largest slave market in the western provinces. Many of the slaves seized in your homeland will still be there, awaiting the winter auctions." "Well garrisoned?" Frentis asked him, although it was Lekran who replied. "At least a division," he said. "As our friend says, Escethians are ever resentful at the loss of their sovereignty, though it happened centuries ago." Frentis eyed the chart closely, gauging the distance from Escethia to Volar. Close enough to threaten the capital, but sufficiently distant to ensure any forces sent against us won't have time to return when the Queen lands. He raised his gaze to Bellarath. "Captain?" "It's not a shore I'm familiar with. May take a while to find a suitable landing site. Luckily, the coming storm should mask our approach from their patrol ships." Frentis nodded. "Escethia, then," he said, hating himself for the dread that clutched at his chest, knowing the decision meant his weeks of dreamless sleep would soon have to be abandoned. "Just one night," he told himself. "What can she do in just one night?" There was a time she would have made them watch, delighting in their impotence as they squirmed in their bonds, helpless witnesses to the slaughter of their families. But for reasons she can't fathom, such diversions hold no interest for her now, and she has been content to gather them atop the council tower, standing at the parapet, with the tip of a sword pricking every back, watching smoke and flames rise from the wealthier districts of the city as their estates are laid waste. It is close to midnight, and the flames are bright. though they are at too great a height to hear the screams. For all their unnatural vitality, these greats of the Empire are now revealed as old men, sagging in grief, weeping or choking out of desperate pleas for mercy, kept upright only by the promise of instant death should they falter. "I realize this may be a redundant statement, honored councilman," she tells them, "but the ally is less than impressed by your efforts to fulfill his great design." She moves to the gray-haired dullard, the one whose name she still can't recall, although she is almost certain he must have known her father as a youth. He wears the formal robes of a councilman, red from head to toe, though a telltale stain is spreading across the fabric around his legs. "Barely a tenth of the forces required have been gathered," she tells the somewhat pungent greyhead, "whilst you present me with an endless parade of ever more pathetic excuses. The ally has ordained a great destiny for this empire, whilst you wallow in your comforts and blind yourselves to the threat growing across the sea." He attempts to beg, but his words emerge in a stumbling, incoherent babble of spit and tears. She lets him burble on and turns an appraising glance on the man standing at his back, dressed in light armor like the Curetai, but armed with but one sword, the blade longer and more slender than the Valerian standard, reminiscent, in fact, of the Asraelin pattern. Also, unlike the Curetai, his armor is enameled in red rather than black. He is of average height, but his body is toned to near perfection, the product of decades of breeding and years of conditioning. It had always been a persistent delusion among these long-lived clods that the Curetai were the ultimate slave soldiers, incapable of improvement, and now here they were, once again proved fatally wrong. The swordsman is aware of her scrutiny, returning her gaze with a respectful nod, a grin of anticipation on his lips. They had been the allies' most cherished project for centuries, a slave soldier capable of thought as well as obedience. But successive generations had proved a disappointment, either too difficult to control or too easy. It was her beloved who had provided the clue. During his time in the pits, they had studied him closely, finding him most deadly when the binding was loosened, when his rage added precious speed to his blows. And so they had begun to change their diet of drugs, subtly alter their training regimen, weeding out those lacking the required spirit. In a few short years, the results achieved had been impressive. "Step forward," she tells the swordsman, and his grin widens as he complies, his sword digging into the councilman's back. The scream is long as he plummets to the ground. She doesn't bother herself to view the result, waving a hand at each of the swordsmen in turn, the councilman forced over the edge with varying degrees of panic and terror, some begging as they fall, as if their pleas will conquer gravity. In a few moments, only one remains. He stands with his back straight, staring fixedly at the northern suburbs where his villa burns, the ornamental lake that surrounds it providing a fine reflection as the air is still tonight. "Nothing to say, Arcliffe?" she asks him. He doesn't react, not even to turn his head. She moves closer, finding his posture oddly noble, stoic in the face of death, refusing to acknowledge his enemy. A classic Valerian pose, worthy of any statue. "I've always wondered," she says, resting her arms on the parapet beside him. "Was it you who proposed the council employ me to assassinate my father?" The question is pointless, she knows. He will not speak to her. She is an unworthy enemy, bereft of consideration, deserving of no more respect than the tiger that eats the unwary traveller. Instead, he chooses to surprise her. "It was not a proposal," he says, face still composed and voice free of any quaver. "It was an order, conveyed by the creature you call the messenger." She stares at him for a moment, then laughs. "Was it reward or enticement?" she wonders. "I ordered your wife and most recently spawned brats be killed quickly," she says. "I felt I owed you that much." He says nothing, his composure still fully in place. She toys with the idea of letting him stand there for a full day, curious to see how long it will take before his legs buckle, but yet again finds her appetite for indulgence diminished this night. "Take him to the vault," she tells the swordsman standing at his back. Arcliffe casts an appalled gaze at her, then lurches forward, trying to launch himself from the parapet, but his guard is too swift, catching him by the legs and dragging him back.
"Kill me!" Arcliffe rages at her. "Kill me, you pestilent bitch!"
"You have too much yet to do, Arcliffe," she replies with an apologetic smile. He continues to rage as his guard drags him to the stairs, his cries echoing all the way down. She lingers for a while, watching the fires, wondering how many living in the city below had any notion of what they portended, of the different world that would greet them on the dawn, a now familiar fugue of confusion settling over her mind. The fires are smaller when she comes back to herself, the confusion fading. How long has she stood here? She turns to one of the swordsmen, the one who had killed the greyhead, finding him viewing her with open admiration, his eyes lingering where the slit in her gown reveals a length of thigh. "Do you know what you are?" she asks him.
"Arisai," he replies, meeting her gaze with a grin. "A servant of the ally."
"No."
She turns back to the city. "You are a slave. In the morning I will be an empress, but also a slave. For we are all slaves now."
She is moving to the stairs when it strikes her, the sensation of his return falling like a hammer blow. She staggers, falling to her knees.
"Beloved!"
Her song swells in welcome and foreboding, the same notes it has always sung in his presence. He is close, she can feel it, the ocean no longer between them. "Beloved, do you come to me?" The song shifts as it touches his hatred. His sweet hatred, a vision coming to her mind, foggy but clear enough to discern a stretch of coastline, tall waves breaking on a rocky shore, a single word in his voice, his wonderful, hate-filled voice. "Escethia."
"Reminds me of Southern Cumbrail," Draker said, shielding his eyes from the sun as he surveyed the landscape. "Did some smuggling there in my youth."
Escethia did indeed bear some resemblance to the realm's driest region, and seemed similarly rich in vineyards, rows of neatly ordered vines stretching away across the running hills, interspersed with an occasional villa or farm building. Frentis glanced back at the sea saber, wallowing in the morning tide. Belleruth had been obliged to land them when the shore was clear of waves to avoid smashing them onto the rocks, resting the hull on the sands before they disembarked.
"I'll ask the gods to favour your mission,"
the captain had called down to Frentis from the stern, casting a wary eye at the shore, his final words a barely heard mutter.
"Though I doubt even they could preserve you here."
"I put us 50 miles south of New Kethia," 34 advised, examining an unfurled map. "If the captain's reckoning is to be trusted."
"Good navigation is about the only thing I'd trust a Maldinian with."
Francis's gaze tracked to the nearest villa, perhaps a quarter mile off, without buildings large enough to be stables.
"It'll be home to a black clad," 34 said, following his gaze. "Too grand for anything else. They're likely to have guards. House Varitai. An estate this large will keep perhaps a dozen." "All to the good."
Frentis gave the sign for the company to adopt the loose skirmish formation he had taught them in the Earlish. "We need to start somewhere." They managed to take Varitai alive, a guard posted on the villa's western side, roped and beaten down by Draker, with 34's assistance. His comrades were not so fortunate, running to confront them with weapons drawn when a panicked slave gave the alarm, screaming shrilly of bandits as she fled back to the house. Frentis had ordered no chances taken, and the fight was short, half the Varitai cut down by their arrows and Ilion's crossbow, before the company closed in with drawn swords to finish the others. "How much they have learned," Frentis thought, finding a grim satisfaction at the efficiency with which his people dealt with the Varitai. Lanky Darlin ducking under a short sword to jab his own into a slave soldier's eyes, then moving behind him to finish it with Draker's trick. Beyond them, Ilion deflected an overhead slash and delivered a deadly counter-thrust, finding a gap in the Varitai's armor just above the breastbone. It was over in a few moments, the company kneeling beside fresh corpses to claim weapons and trinkets, a ritual born in the forest.
"Leave that," Frentis barked. "Search the villa. If he hasn't fled, the owner will be in the upper rooms. Draker, take 34 and gather the slaves."
"Red brother." Lekran stood at the arched entrance to the villa's courtyard, wiping blood from his axe, his expression dark.